he didn't have that many more great ballplayers. The Reds have had great ballplayers. Johnny Vandermeer's two no-hitters. Yul Blackwell, men that have gone down into the Hall of Fame, yet they seem to be the glory road. What was it, the Boys of Summer and the Lords of Flatbush, and that's out in the movie now, and all these things just seem to appeal to the people. What is the mystique of a Brooklyn Dodger or of a New York Yankee or of a New York Giant as compared to the Cincinnati Reds?
I've often wondered that too, because the Reds are more dramatic and they're older, and my conclusion is that it's entirely to the news media located. It's a big focal point there. A lot of writers who, when you have a lot of baseball writers, some of them become authors. And they're highly publicized. For example, I think right now if Pete Rose or Johnny Bench, while they're highly publicized, if they were in New York playing on either of the New York teams, they'd be a byword on everybody's tongue almost. So I think it's entirely due to the news media, the fact that there are so many writers there. There were three teams at one time. And because I know when I moved the office from Cincinnati, or from New York here, after been there 75 years, our owners objected a lot to it because they said, well, Cincinnati's a small town and you don't get the news coverage, the news services there, the wire services. And so I think that's it.
Well, you know, some of the New York writers like to refer to Cincinnati and Dew as something in the West, almost going back to the cowboy and Indian days. Yet I think one thing they forget is the fact that this farm boy is the one that made the Dodgers and the Yankees and the Giants great. And yet when they got to New York, well, they seemed to be more sophisticated. And the Reds always seemed to be farm boys to them. But actually, their teams were made up of men from Appalachia and so on, but they seem to overlook all that.
They do. They really do. They just, well, when they become New Yorkers, they become great for some reason or other. When they become Reds, their records stand out and they're published, they're publicized according to their records, but they're not built up, we'll say, by the local news media, never have been. And I think it's due entirely to the industry of the news writers there, and the fact that there was great competition. The more newspapers you have, the more competition, the more interesting stories you dig up.
You know, talking about Johnny Bench a second ago, not so long ago, he appeared on Hee Haw, and there seems to be a great closeness between some major league ball players, and in fact a lot of them, and country music. You had the St. Louis Cardinals with the Mudcat Band, with Pepper Martin and Fiddler Bill McGee in that group. Is there any reason other than the fact that they play baseball possibly longer in the South, or possibly the farm boy has a different outlook on baseball? Dizzy Dean, what he do, started to throw rocks at a barn, the way he built that arm up. But I noticed that down through baseball history, there's been a very close, I was talking to Joe Nuxall not so long ago, and he said one of the first things he did on a Saturday night in Chicago was go to WLS and watch the National Barn Dance, and it just seems to carry down through baseball. Have you ever noticed it, and do you have a reason for it?
Well, the only reason is just the thing you just mentioned, is that they are their country boys, and their heart is more in the country and the farm and the small town and all the things that are related to that. I think they're just closer to it. They're not stuffy. Baseball is not a stuffy game. Baseball is a homespun game, and it's a sandlot game, and it just doesn't smack of high buildings, and smacks of big, it's related more to cornfields and big pastures where you can play ball, rather than these confined lots to the city. And so when they grow up and the boys come to the major leagues, and their development is in the minor leagues, which are some of them very, very small, and their first exposure to baseball is country, we'll say. It's just small town, and I think that's definitely the reason. I think that's the reason that you talk about the Mudcats and the Cardinals and the Gas House Gang. And see, baseball are very unsophisticated ball players. They used to be anyway, and they're becoming more sophisticated. And you take football, 9 out of 10 is a college graduate. That's where they go. We go down the sticks to get our ball players, and they go to the colleges. And I think baseball, while they're intelligent, educated, the baseball players, I think down in their heart, their family background is country.
Do you think the fan of 1970s, for instance, is missing out on a lot of the dramatics, a lot of the exposure that baseball offered them in the 30s and the 40s? Do you think that they are now becoming a computerized type of fan, and that they're happy with what they're seeing, and are happy in being a fan in the 1970s because they really don't know what they've missed?
I think it's the it's human nature. I think it's everybody wants to drive a big car. Everybody wants to drive the car like the boss drives. And they like to go to the big affairs. They like to go where the stars are. It's becoming more and more that way. And baseball is, interest is on the increase. As a matter of fact, some years ago, say 7 or 8 years ago, baseball attendance had increased in a greater proportion than the population of the United States. And it was quite interesting to read those statistics. I think before they got the big stadia, where you were up in the upper deck and far removed, where you couldn't emotionally quite feel the ball player as you could. You could see him, but you can't feel him like you can if you were 50 feet away when you're 300 feet away. And I think the smaller ballparks, people watching, the spectators, were more a part of the players on the field because they were closer. Now, I think Crosley Field was as warm, it was antiquated in relation to the new stadia, but as warm a ballpark, I really mean warm in hot days too, but the warmth, I'm speaking of a different kind of warmth. I'm thinking of a camaraderie that you feel there, that you don't feel in the big stadia. I think largely that some of the hero worship of the ball player today is not as deep as it was. And I can remember where the people would, this particularly in the minor leagues, the higher minor leagues, and oftentimes in the major leagues, where there'd be some fan with a nice home and would invite 6 or 8 ball players out to his home for dinner. Well, that's kind of lost in the shuffle a little bit now, as so many other things are with what we call progress.
The hero worship, I would imagine, has always been, now I may be wrong, possibly this wasn't true in the 30s, up until in the 40s. But I think there has been a lot of hero worship right possibly up to 1970 as far as the young girls are concerned around the league. I imagine a girl is very impressed with a movie star, a baseball star, or anyone in public life, possibly even a political figure. Would you think that, that hero worship is of some status now in the United States, and do you think it has become more so since the 30s?
I think the hero worship by the young teenagers for the ball player has increased. I don't recall until the last few years of there being fan clubs. Now, these Johnny Bench fan clubs, they're 90% gals, and they don't see men having fan clubs of certain ball players. And I think the ladies' days, they're still big. But here at Crosley Field, the ladies' days was just a packed house every time we'd, probably because we limited them. I think there's some value in making things a little bit hard to get. And ladies' days were well attended, and Ernie Lombardi was a hero of the ladies, and I'll never be able to understand it. They just loved the guy, and he wouldn't say hello to any of them hardly. It was an unusual thing. But I still don't remember any Ernie Lombardi fan club. Now there's Pete Rose, Johnny Morgan, Joe Morgan, and we had several others that had fan clubs around.
Mr. Giles, the travel, the color of the travel in the 30s and 40s, when the Reds were winning two pennants back to back, the train compared to the jet plane, and the receptions that the ball club received in other cities, that is, as far as the fans were concerned, as far as the sports writers were concerned, and what were those trips like? Could you give me a little color, a little background on the travel and what the ball players would do on the trains, what they would do with their time in other cities, and what cities were best received as far as the fans were concerned when you'd come in, and how about the sports writers, the ones that would give you the best coverage when you would come in?
Of course, the traveling by the train was conducive to camaraderie and companionship, and I know that the sports writers now, some of them say that they talk about the terrible rough trips on the cold or on the cold sleepers and the warm coaches sometimes, that it was an inconvenience, but frankly all of them who have enjoyed the travel in the past on the train and travel on the airplane now is that they enjoyed the there was a closeness on the train that they didn't have, particularly in the dining car. That's where they would go in and eat. And the sports writer would sit down with two or three players, and he would eat there. And now the players have charter airplanes, and the only people on the plane are the ball players. In the olden days, they'd have their sleeper and have their coach, but other people would come in there sometime, and they'd be constantly passing through. And if you didn't put the coach on the rear of the train, people just walk through and back and back and forth just to see the ball players and maybe visit with them, say, "Aren't you so-and-so? Aren't you Paul Derringer? Aren't you Bucky Walters?" And shake hands with them. And there was a lot of inconvenience and, let's say, hardships. It was better than the buses down in the minor leagues. And then it's graduated now to airplane travel, first class, and the big difference I've noticed is that the ball players would handle their own baggage, get it to the hotel, get their own cabs, and now the road secretary has a baggage truck come and take it to the hotel, and the bell captain puts it in their room, their name is on the bag, and when they go into the hotel, they find their bag in their room. And it's not much difference in other things that have progressed. It's the easier life now than it was back in the 30s and 40s. But I think the train travel, I used to enjoy it thoroughly. I did, particularly in the dining car, where you'd sit around and gas, just talk and visit. And that's kind of gone. Now, the ball players now do a lot more sleeping, I think, on the plane, but that's because of night travel, night games. Mm-hmm. I don't recall many going to sleep on the train, leaning back in their chair car, parlor car, going to sleep, but now they sleep and play cards now. That seems to be, and they have their dinner served, but everyone eats alone, more or less. It's not like being around a table with four or six. And the big difference, I think the sports writers were closer to the ball players. They were a little bit more accessible, I think, than they are on an airplane. And I don't notice any difference when you land or when you arrive at a airport now than when you arrived at the at a station, except that there'll be half a dozen airplanes arriving at the big cities at the same time. Usually with a train, you'd be the only group coming in at that particular time, and were more noticeable by because of that. And the greetings, I think one of the biggest ones that I ever saw was right down here at the Covington Airport when the Reds came back from the first games of the playoff at Pittsburgh, and when they came back from Oakland in the World Series. Tremendous crowd, just tremendous, you couldn't get through. And I didn't ever see that. Of course, they didn't have the chance except on one or two occasions to greet the Reds. They didn't excite the fans that much. But I think the fan is just about as willing to go to the airport now and have groups enthusiastically greet the ball players. I know we would, one thing is, makes it a little bit easier for some of the fans to get out to the airport if they feel like it, particularly the players' families, to meet them with the transportation, players' wives. Because they have the radio now, and you've probably heard it, where the announcer will say, well, this game will be over in a few minutes, and the schedule now is for the players to arrive, and they should arrive at the airport at X time.
Mr. Giles, were there any cities in the 30s and 40s when you were with the Reds that you and the ball players looked forward to going into and playing in? Were there any cities that you did look forward to for any reason of going into and playing a series?
Well, I personally liked Chicago as a city, but the Chicago club just seemed to, we just couldn't win in Chicago, so I didn't like to go there so much. But New York I liked. Philadelphia was real good to us. I didn't care too much for the city, but I liked to go there because we had a good chance to win. And New York I didn't care too much about because they, I'll never forget in the World Series of 1939, we went in there and some Red Rooters had cars and they were had pennants, welcome Reds. And I got a call from the secretary of the Chamber of Commerce if I'd please ask them to take down the, not display the signs at the ballpark or anyplace else, Cincinnati Reds, because it, the connotation with the Reds, the communist Reds and all that. And I'm not going to tell you what I told him. we continued to say Cincinnati Reds, whether he thought the Russians were coming or not. But it was just one of those things where New York wasn't one of my favorite spots. A lot of fine people there, but as I said, I'm a Midwest country boy.
How was St. Louis? How did St. Louis treat you?
Real good. St. Louis, real good. I liked St. Louis. I really did. It was. The only thing is the ballpark was terribly hot. We played games, day games, and terribly hot. And the Browns and the Cardinals used the same field, and they just couldn't, with the hot weather they had down there, they just couldn't. The infield like playing on a rock pile, and I think the Cardinals had a little advantage because they were more accustomed to it, and of course if you make them strike them out, well, it didn't make any difference. But ground balls were hard to handle. The infield was very bad, but I liked St. Louis. I liked it very much, really did. I was in the St. Louis Cardinal farm system for years before I came to Cincinnati, and that was one reason, I think, that I liked St. Louis as a city and as a place to play.
Did most of the cities have their ballparks located in rather precarious areas of the city? Chicago's north side used to be pretty nice, I think, in the 40s. Now it's changed a lot to the Puerto Rican element, which still isn't so bad out there. But I was wondering if most of the other cities at that time had the ballparks located in rather precarious positions in the city, or if there were any nice locations of ballparks, and what ballparks were the best seating, where the fans had the most enjoyment to watch a ball game.
I didn't notice any parks at all that seemed to be located in a bad area, but it was because of daytime baseball, largely. Now, some of the areas now, you take Wrigley Field, it's in a fine area. But Phil Wrigley told me just less than 3 or 4 years ago that if he were playing at night games at Wrigley Field, they'd have problems too, just like the White Sox park did. And it's, I think the day, playing in the daytime eliminated much of the the undesirability of the element that was around there. And but they were all now Boston, we'd get off at the Back Bay station and be just a short distance from the hotel. And now the players have buses, and they used to take taxi cabs in. And I don't recall any city at all that was hard to get to the ballpark, or hard to get to the hotel, or where there was any problem at all.
What was the ballpark in Boston, the old league ball? That was an old league park up there where the Bees played. And before they became the Braves and moved to Milwaukee, what area of town was that ballpark located in? It isn't there anymore. And just what kind of a park was it?
It was a real nice area. Real nice area. There's a lot of university property around there, and excellent area. I think the trouble with the Braves Field, they had the Braves and the Bees, but the Braves Field, we call it, was that it was so big in relation to the attendance that they had, and a big open chasm. Some of it didn't have a roof on it, and I think psychologically that it was too big. And when they'd have 4,000 and 5,000 and 6,000 people out there, the it left you depressed. It was, I think, the psychological atmosphere of having a few people watch a ballpark in those great big stands. Now, if the stands had been constructed differently, they could have had just as many seats, but just the way it was constructed, almost, well, it's hard to describe, but like a big football stadium, no roof over part of it, and roof only over part of it, but no levels, just all one big...
One level.
Yeah, just one level. You get to the bottom and you walk to the top, and... nice playing field and in a real good area. But I think that helped discourage people from coming out there.
Was that near Boston University?
Yes, very near it.
Was it right on the Charles River?
Yes, that's right.
How was that in...
Nice spot, I thought.
How was that in relation to the Red Sox Park?
Well, the Red Sox Park is... it wasn't very close. Red Sox Park is... Right in a residential district, you can walk to it from some fine homes and clubs and two hotels that you can walk to if you want to walk a little bit.
Now, in the Boston situation today, the Red Sox, they have not the White Sox, but the Cubs, a great following of young people. And when I was in Chicago, we discussed the fact that the Cubs are almost like a babysitting thing for the people. They're not afraid to send the kids out on the L. They're not afraid to let them come out and see daytime baseball in Wrigley Field. And for a dollar, where can you get a better deal than big league baseball? And the stands are constructed so that you can sit in a dollar seat in the bleachers and be just about as close as you could in any other ballpark, where if you come to Riverfront Stadium, you could pay $3.50 and be completely away from the action. This was the thinking of why the young people came to Wrigley Field so much in Chicago. What's your thinking about Boston and also Chicago?
Well, I think you've correctly outlined what my thinking on Wrigley Field, but you must also think that it's a daytime baseball. The problems are magnified at night. Whatever few problems there are, they're magnified at night, as any disturbance is in the city. Fenway Park is just it's an old ballpark, but a delightful place to watch a ball game. It's a warm, homey, close to the ball field ballpark. And I think that's what's conducive to their great attendance up there, and because they only seat 34,000 people at the top, and that makes people want to go because it's hard to get. Something's hard to get. Mm-hmm. Seats are hard to get, and I know in constructing the new stadiums around the country, it's got to a point where you have to have two major tenants for municipalities to build a stadium, and it's football, and football playing seven games a year, maybe at home, and once a week, they depend on a one shot a week, and they want a lot of seats, and where you play every day for 80 days, for nearly, you miss a few days here and there, but when you play practically every day for 3-4 months, it's you don't want so many seats, because the feeling, the psychological feeling of feeling alone. People, baseball fans like to feel that they are a part of something, and if they can intermingle and be close to people and maybe get in an argument with somebody, but if they're scattered all over the place, well, it's not so much fun. And so when they build these stadiums now, they always have the baseball tenant pressures for limited seating, and the football team want as many seats as they can get. So it's to strike a happy medium, which they did here at Riverfront Stadium. It's about 52 or 3,000 people, which is adequate for football, although I think they'd like to have 60,000 sometimes. But baseball, they don't want it too big, because they can't draw those big crowds often. Well, I think it was remarkable that they, here at Riverfront Stadium, they had over 50,000 3 days in a row. Now, I don't think football or any place else would ever do that. I think baseball has established a record that will never be surpassed, I don't think, and that was the World Series out at the Coliseum, when they had over 90,000 people for three successive days. And that goes back to the seating, the warmth of the thing. Of course, Major League Baseball was new out there then, and that was the reason. And the Dodgers drew like the Dickens. It was inadequate. The Coliseum was a terrible place to play ball, but people wanted to come out and see the players perform. And you'd be so far away you couldn't recognize the players, even with a scorecard. Mm-hmm.